You know, there are all kinds of interesting people who live right around your neighborhood, like, oh, the publicist, the rights distribution manager.
Would you look at that? It's people in your neighborhood on 95BFM.
Oh, hi there.
Shh, listen.
I love that intro. Today we are, we have Graham Reed in the studio. Graham Reed is a journalist, author, broadcaster and arts educator. His film and music reviews have appeared in the New Zealand Herald since the late 80s, and his website elsewhere provides features and reports on music, film, travel and other cultural issues. He is the author of two travel books. Yep, and also... I'm getting this title right. Professional Teaching Fellow at the University School of Music. That's, welcome.
That's what they say, Professional Teaching Fellow. I think I can be honest about that. What it means is they don't employ me full-time. They just employ me on a term-by-term basis. And they have been doing that for over 10 years now. So I think it gets them out of paying me, you know, holiday pay or something. I've never been entirely happy with it, but look, you do what you do in this world.
Yeah, I love the fact that it is, the title is Professional Teaching Fellow. As we said off air before, I was just like, ooh, Professional Teaching Fellow.
Yeah. I, you know, that's when you put your thumbs in your braces or something. Like, I'm a fellow who teaches. Yeah, it's fun. I really enjoy it.
Yeah. So I've met you on several occasions and been lucky to attend your yearly lunch for, you know, publicists and promoters and things like that. But a lot of people will know your name, but don't maybe like, and will know your, you know, your reviews and your website and things like that. But can you tell us a bit about your background, about how you became Graham Reed?
I'm going to correct you there, Penny, because I don't think any of your audience would know me at all, because the stuff that I did was quite some time ago. I trained as a teacher. I came to this university here and I was doing sciences and I failed abysmally. So they kicked me out and I had to find something to do. And so I went to Teachers College just as a stopgap measure while I thought of something else. And I ended up teaching. I was at what was called Penrose High School at the time and Glenfield College. And I was just teaching, English and art history and things like that there. but all the time, even when I was at university here and when I was doing teacher training and whatever, I was always writing. I was one of those people. You know, I know it sounds terrible. My wife says you shouldn't say it. It actually comes easy to me, and mm-hmm. I know that it comes hard to other people. But it does. Writing comes easy to me, always has done. And so, seriously, you know, what I really wanted out of life was free records, because I absolutely broke at that time, and I had a young family too, you know, I had kids real early. And I figured out the way to get free records was to write about them, and record companies would give you them. And it worked really, really well. In fact, it's worked right up until the days of streaming, you know, up until about 3 years ago, you know, I'd still get CDs and records and cassettes and stuff like that. Now people just send you a link, and so that's no fun. So that's sort of what I did, and I just started writing for the local newspaper and then Metro magazine. I wrote short stories for them. I wrote for The Listener, for the arts columns in The Listener, and then sort of fell into writing part-time for The Herald. I like jazz, you know, unashamed about that, and I like sort of edgy jazz too, as much as, you know, sort of slightly more mainstream. Blue Note stuff is kind of mainstream these days. And so I started writing about jazz and all sorts of other things for the Herald, and then a vacancy came up. And this is why your people wouldn't know me, because that vacancy came up in 1987, mm-hmm. which is way before most of your listeners were born, probably before you were. Yeah, before you were born, you know.
Oh no, so, I wish.
No, come on. I'm sitting opposite you. You weren't born then. And so I started at the Herald in 1987 as a journalist. They got me on doing entertainment, because that's what I was supposed to do, and I was interviewing, you know, they were famous people at the time. I don't know that anybody would know them now, but you know, lots and lots of people. Well, the guys from Led Zeppelin and people like that, you know.
I think people would know.
People would know who they are. Yeah. And so, you know, I interviewed those people, you know, fly off to the States or Australia or UK or whatever, just to interview those people. But over a period of time, because I was travelling so much doing that, and I liked to get out of this country, I would actually file travel stories for the Herald as well as a kind of bonus. And mm-hmm. they thought, oh, this is cool, you know. So I became the travel guy as much as the sort of rock and roll guy. And then they sort of clicked at one point that I wasn't actually as stupid as I looked. And so I ended up doing some political writing. So I became this kind of, just by sheer chance, this kind of quite well-rounded journalist. And so when I decided to leave in 2004, and that was 17 years there, it's a long time, I had no idea what I was going to do. I just walked, you know, I just resigned and walked out the door 4 weeks later, sort of thing. They told me I was irreplaceable, and I left on the Friday, and the lovely Scott Carr was sitting in my desk on the Monday. That's how bloody irreplaceable you can be in life. And I just waited to see what would happen, and what happened was the Herald, you know, continued to get me doing things, and other people got me to do things because I knew I could meet a deadline and I could spell. And then over a period of time, I did a brief stint of lecturing just part-time at AUT in the media, you know, communications or whatever they call it. I hated it, actually. You know, it was setting up people to be journalists when the jobs were, you know, imploding, and they were teaching them stuff that I just thought, that's absolutely irrelevant, you know. And so I was very happy when I started to get little job offers from the university here. And the next thing I know, I'm taking papers in the School of Music, and you know, I'm creating papers in the School of Music. That's what I did for a while. And so I think it'd be over 10 years. I've just been doing a number of, mostly in the popular music area, but also there's been one quite important one, which is about sort of music industry studies.
Yep.
That's been for first, second, and then last semester, the second semester last year, it was for third year students. Because they need to know about copyright, and they need to know about, you know, owning their, you know, their music. And often on the first day I say to them, look, you know, basically fuck out, this is commerce, you know. Yep. This is about making money out of music. And they're a bit horrified, and I say, well, look, you don't make money, you don't get to do it again. And I want you, as a consumer of music, I want you to make money so you do it again. And if I don't like what you do the first time, it doesn't matter. But at some point, you'll do something that I really like, and I'll be glad of that. And the music industry, of course, you know, they're always on the lookout for talent. So it's in their best interests that musicians have a viable career. And to do that, you do need to know about copyright.
Yeah, it's quite weird, isn't it? Because a lot of people will think that if they put the commerce into their music, that they're kind of selling out. But they're not, you know, they're actually just learning to make a living off
absolutely
their creativity, yeah. You know, and yeah, it's really exactly important, like, because if you want to keep doing it and be sustainable, you know, in your industry, then you have to make money off it.
If you're an electrician, you know, what are you, you're making money out of the passion that you have for, you know, wiring or whatever like that, you know, and if you are one of those people, you know, why would you not make money out of that? And you know, you continue a bit of study, or you learn as you go. And so, you know, I'm quite sort of pragmatic about that. I just think that people should know and should protect their art, because it is an art form. And so they have to know. And these days, of course, you know, how do you get stuff up on Spotify?
Yeah.
How do you put your song out there in the world and get it some attention? That's the problem. It's never been easier to make music. We know that. And it's actually never been easier to put it out in the world through, you know, Bandcamp, SoundCloud, Spotify, all of these things. You can just put it out there. What the trick is getting people to pay attention to it.
Yeah.
It's not just a song. It's among millions of other songs that are going out all the time. So that's the thing. You know, you have to create that profile for yourself and get people engaged and interested in what you do.
Yeah. So for that paper, is that part of the actual whole music degree?
Yes. It has been in the past. It has been part of, like, mostly pop music students do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to say this, they don't work hard enough. You know, like, I mean, when I say work hard enough, they're not playing enough. That's a problem, I think. You know, you need to get out there and play somewhere regularly. The more you play, the better you get. I mean, everybody knows this. But in the paper that I did the second semester last year, 2/3 of them were actually classical music students.
Right.
You know, who were looking for a career in classical music. Now, at the end, I had to suddenly change that paper because I was presuming that most of them would be pop music students, and actually most of them weren't. And you have to ask yourself, well, how much do classical music students need to know about, let's say,
I was going to ask about
copyright,
that. Yeah.
You know, like if you're going to do Brahms, you know, what's the story on copyright? Nothing, really.
Yeah.
play your bloody Brahms, you know. Right at the very end of the course, and I still included all that because I'm trying to accommodate them as well as the pop music students, I asked them, I said, look, you know, you guys, let's be frank. I'm absolutely honest with you, so you be honest with me. Was this of any use to you? And even though some of these students were coming back to do masters and will go into maybe an academic career teacher, they all said the same thing. They said, no, that was really useful. We needed to know that, you know, in case we write our own music or compose our own stuff, you know. So I think they're very valuable papers. I really do. But again, I say, like, if you're a young musician, you need to work. You need to get out there and play as often as possible. That's how you create an audience. You create a vibe for yourself. You create a sense of visibility. And, you know, you get on your social media. So the second you put your first single out, people actually know who you are. You know, that's the key factor. Yeah. And then 6 weeks later, you put a second one out. You don't sit around waiting for that one to catch on Spotify or go, oh, shit, it didn't work. No, you put a second one out.
Do you think that they have the perception that people are kind of discovered instantly and it's not like there isn't?
Well, you know, you have to explain that Ed Sheeran played 500 concerts for free before he got paid.
Yeah.
I think there is the myth. I suspect that it's been dissipated quite a bit lately, but there was that myth that you could be an overnight sensation on YouTube, you know, and then people figured out, yeah, you can get 20 million hits on YouTube. It doesn't actually make you any money, and it doesn't necessarily set you up for anything, you know, other than, I don't know, being an influencer or something. I don't know what those people do, but, you know, that I think people now understand that can be just a one-off, just a blip on the radar, and the person who was that blip is actually forgotten within 6 to 8 weeks because there's another blip on the radar. Much as I don't like what the Kardashians stand for, take your hat off to them. Man, they kept that thing going, haven't they?
Indeed.
About a decade or something, is it? Like, they're just, it's the never-ending story, that one.
It's weird, isn't it? Because, like, you could also be, I mean, you know, like, not very talented and be renowned for that, you know, like there's certain songs on
the Kardashians' particular
talent. Yeah, well, that's the thing, you know, marketing, you know.
A sex tape, I believe.
Yeah. But apparently that was what started it off.
Yeah.
Which I didn't know. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I was like thinking of
with all due respect, anybody can make a sex tape.
Yeah. it's whether people want to watch it or not.
That's right, yeah. People know how to do that, you know. So,
because there was that the woman, is it Rebecca Black or something, who sang the song about Friday, and her I think her father was quite wealthy and they put it on YouTube and she became quite famous, but because, you know, because the song was not particularly good.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not quite sure what she's up to now, though.
No, but you know, then there are, you know, there are wealthy, talented people come through. Lana Del Rey is an example, you know. I mean, Lana Del Rey has got money behind her. She had money behind her. She's a, you know, upper middle class, you know, white girl who, you know, had connections. And I actually have no problem with that, you know, because at the end of it, all you're going to judge them on is the music.
Yeah.
That's the end. For me, that's the beginning and the end of it. The rest of it is interesting backstory, but the fact is that, you know, you've got to put up or shut up on the music, and, you know, people like that, they can do it.
Yeah.
There's no reason why they shouldn't be able to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. You also do what paper you're doing tomorrow.
I got a summer school, and I've been doing this for a few years, and it's enormously popular.
Sounds fascinating. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, it's basically the history of New Zealand popular music from after the Second World War. So, you know, we're looking at sort of about 1949 onwards, and, you know, I moved through it sort of chronologically because it just makes it easy for people. Like, this happened in 1949, mid-1950s rock and roll comes along. Then what happens after that? Well, you know, the Beatles arrive and that changes the musical landscape again. And then, you know, basically drugs arrive in the late 1960s and that changes the music again. And we just work our way through up to the present day. But I put it in the social history, you know, the context of it all. The example I would give, because it's the easiest example you can, is that Herb's album, What's Be Happened, that came out in 1981. Well, to fully understand what that's about, you just got to look at the decade before. And in the decade before, well, it was the Ngā Tamatoa movement, young warriors that came out of this university. There was the Dawn Raids, which happened, shameful period in New Zealand history, started under Labour, continued under National. So, yeah, you know, rousing people out of their beds at dawn, bloody disgraceful. And, you know, and then you've got the Hikui in 75, you know, and occupation of Bastion Point. And all of those things, and then the Springbok tour arrives, all of those things factor in to make you understand why Herbs did what they did on that album. You know, a highly politicised album, which also, you know, it didn't just sort of take aim at all those issues. It actually took aim at its own people too, which is something that most people tend to overlook. You know, they talked about the power of the church, the hold that the church had on Pacifica people. So all of that, you know, explains what What's Be Happen is about. And the thing that I say to my students is actually, you'd be more surprised if Herbs had made an album that was not political than political. It was going to be political. So, you know, just doing all of those things all the way through, you know, the Queen Street riots that happened down just down the road here, why that happened, you know, like 4 years after the Springbok tour.
Yeah, can you tell us a bit about the Queen Street riots?
Yeah, this is the famous thing, 1984, I think, four or five, I can't remember right off the top of my head. End of the year, it was a sort of thank God it's Friday thing. And there were bands playing for free down in Aotea Square. And Dave Dobbin was one of the people playing, and the story is that, and of course there's multiple stories about it, but the short of it is what happened was that the, you know, the police arrived en masse and started to push people, and people pushed back. Well, you know, as many people would observe, the Springbok tour changed the game, you know, like, the policeman was not actually your friend. That's what a lot of white middle class people discovered. I think young brown people kind of already knew that because they'd been through the Dawn Raids and hassled on the streets of Ponsonby. And so pushback was inevitable, you know. And so there was this riot on Queen Street, and, you know, shop windows were broken, and, you know, people took on the cops who had long batons, the batons that were supposed to be only used in the Springbok tour, but now here they come out again, you know. So, you know, it was just a bit of a fight back, and regrettably, as always happens, you always want to find somebody to blame. So who's to blame for that? Bloody Dave Dobbin, you know. So,
yeah, I heard that they blamed him.
Dave Dobbin has to go to court and defend himself on a very serious charge. I think it was inciting a riot, which is a prisonable offence. And so, you know, Dave Dobbin had to go and defend himself in court.
That's crazy.
He was acquitted, but, you know, it's significant that a couple of years later he left the country. You know, I don't blame him for doing that. I think he just needed to breathe after that, you know, emotional turmoil. And you and I can't begin to imagine what that must be like, you know, going to the High Court, I guess it was, charged with, you know, an offence which could see you put in prison.
Yeah, and all you're doing is playing your music. Yeah.
and basically saying whatever he said, you know, fuck the cops, or the cops are pushing back, you know. Whatever he said, I mean, that's all lost in the mist of time now.
Yeah.
And, you know, honestly, I'm sure that Dave probably doesn't even remember what he said. You know, it was a momentary thing. But, you know, we're great at finger pointing. We always want to find somebody to blame. Because then if you find somebody to blame, you don't have to think of the bigger picture. Oh, it was that person's fault. So, you know, so the music course actually sort of factors all this stuff in and comes up to, well, it comes up to the present day.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Lord factor and how that's had a trickle down and that kind of thing. So,
super interesting stuff.
The students seem to find it so, I have to say.
Yeah.
You know, we talk about Maori show bands, which is up until, I would say maybe up until 10, 15 years ago, was largely a forgotten piece of New Zealand musical history because their careers happened overseas for the most part. And so they were not visible to us, so there wasn't a lot written about them, not a lot of live footage. But a very, very significant part of the development of New Zealand popular music.
Is that things like the Howard Morrison?
Well, no, Howard Morrison Quartet weren't exactly a show band. I always sort of have to make that distinction, although my students, despite me saying they are not a show band, they're not a show band, they will tell me the Howard Morrison Quartet are a show band. Just as some of my students will tell me the Beatles are a boy band. And when they say that, I say, if you say that, you know, I'm going to come around and firebomb your fucking lawn. You know, I know where you live. I would make that distinction. They were something quite separate. The show bands are these sort of big, multi-talented groups of people. You had to be able to, you know, sing in unison, sing in harmony. You had to be able to probably play three different instruments.
Right.
You had to be able to good at telling jokes, do impersonations, sing big ballads, sing quiet songs, and keep up with the music of the day because you're having to refresh your act constantly. The amount of talent in those show bands is just, it's second to none.
So were they performing other people's songs as well as their own?
Yeah, see, that's the problem with it because, you know, there have been albums released of the show bands, but they don't make any sense because, you know, they're singing a big Dean Martin ballad and you think, yeah, well, okay, Dean Martin sang that. But the fact is that if you were there on the night, it would have been really great because they were just sort of presenting pop hits of the day and peppering through comedy and also singing Te Reo, which is very important. You know, they took Te Reo internationally. Annamarie Volcanics, for example, you know, the Pew Pew, and they just kind of introduced, let's be honest, I think some of it's for their own purposes because, you know, it was their point of difference from the Indonesian or Malaysian show band.
Yeah.
This is a New Zealand show band. But you have to remember that in the late 1960s, early 1970s, there wasn't, you know, people overseas didn't know that much about this country. And so here's this sort of exotic, you know, beautiful Maori women, handsome Maori men up on stage doing this and obviously incredibly talented and very funny and also presenting a piece of culture that people had not seen before.
I heard somewhere that that up until like the 1970s or probably even later, that when you came to New Zealand, it was almost like you set your clock back 30 years because it was so different from everywhere else.
I went to Bluff just before Christmas and it's true, it was closed. That is true. I think for tourists, you know, people who come here at that time, some of that is true. We do tend to sort of overplay that a little bit, you know. I mean, I wasn't born here, but, you know, basically grew up here. Mm. And, you know, we had a very large Jewish family attached to ours, you know. So, you know, I grew up with, you know, matzo bread and, you know, all the Jewish cuisine because that's what these people had. And you could go to, let's be honest, they weren't very good, but there were Chinese restaurants and Larder ran El Matador, which, you know, ostensibly did Italian food, shrimp cocktails and stuff. But, you know, it wasn't quite that sort of meat and potatoes, white bread thing that a lot of people like to think. And you see it more recently in cafe culture, you know. Most baristas say you couldn't get a decent cup of coffee in this country until they came along. You know,
yeah.
I make the best coffee, you know. Well, yes, you could actually. You can get good coffee here. Okay, it was different, but you could get fairly decent coffee here in, you know, the 1970s for sure.
Yeah.
But yes, I think, certainly a cultural wasteland in as much as, there was two TV channels and I think they went off air at 10 o'clock or something like that.
Yeah, good night, Kiwi.
Yeah, well, you know, that says it all, eh? You know, like, go to bed, New Zealanders. Yeah. Go to bed. And if you're a kid and you're allowed to stay up and see the Goodnight Kiwi, you know, it's wow. It was a completely different society. And in that New Zealand music paper, it pains to point that out. I mean, I show them pictures of Newmarket in 1950.
Yeah.
I mean, it's gridlock, just like it is today. But, of course, they're big old trucks and the photograph, the Onehunga railway station, always gets a laugh.
You know,
like it's sort of just a silly old building. So, yes, it was a very, very different world. No Harbour Bridge, you know, nothing on the North Shore, basically.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was like about 1967 or something.
1960, So, and then that suddenly the whole of the North Shore opened up and, you know, now where does Auckland end? Christ, it's way past Aotearoa now, isn't it, you know?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Do you have a favourite time for music?
No. A few years ago, I was brought on board as the content editor or content advisor for the big exhibition of New Zealand popular music up at the
Museum. Volume.
Volume,
yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
And that was my job to tell them what should be in it, basically. And, you know, one of the things you learn very quickly is that if people grew up in the 1960s, that was the best ever year, best decade for New Zealand music. And the Flying Nun people will tell you that, you know, it was not 1980s, obviously. And then, of course, you talk to hip-hop people, and they're going to say, well, 90s onwards, you know. So I don't have any particular period that I think was any better or than any others. I do find at the moment there is this kind of strange thing going on, the vice of exceptionalism, that, you know, New Zealanders are absolutely exceptional at all things that we do, and it's absolutely not true. You know, mm-hmm. We're as good as anybody else, but, you know, some things we bungee jumping, we're probably better, I don't know. But, but you know, if you see what's happening now, people talk about the 1960s, and I contribute to audio culture, and, you know, there is the feeling there amongst those people who grew up in the 1960s that all those bands in the 1960s were just absolutely amazing. And I did a piece about a group called Dedication, who came out of Lower Hutt, if I remember. And, you know, it was like, oh, Dedication were the, you know, greatest band around at that time or whatever. Well, they may well have been live. I never saw them live, obviously, but all they did was covers.
Yeah.
You know, their whole album is covers. And while they are very good covers, and there's no doubt about it, they were very good versions, they were a covers band. So,
yeah.
You know, when people say, well, you know, they were an exceptional band, I just think, well, there's that vice of exceptionalism.
Yeah.
You know, so we can fall into that trap, I think. And I try to keep a fairly, you know, clear-eyed view of it, that, yes, those people are very good. Those people are amazing. And those people are okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about earlier on when you were travelling overseas to write with artists, like write about artists or interview artists? Like, did you have any favourite, like, escapades or people that you met?
Yes. Indeed I did. I never want to see Ali Campbell of UB40 ever again. He was an annoying little shit and a really aggressive drunk. The other guys in the band were actually very nice. You know, I went to see them in Manchester and had a nice time with them at their sort of so-called clubhouse, which stank of dope. It was unbelievable.
Contact high.
Yeah, exactly. And just walked in the door and thought, oh, I'm having a good time today. But, yeah, I mean, it was business, a lot of it, in a sense that, you know, you go and you meet somebody, you talk to them, you know, you maybe follow them, you know, go on the limo to the show, you know, that sort of thing. But, you know, I was clear-eyed about it. Sometimes I was a fan of the people.
Yeah.
But my job was not to get autographs and photographs with them. I don't think I got any of those things. I should have, you know. I realise now that I should have got. You know,
it's quite hard though when you're interviewing somebody who's really well known, or you meet them. And if you're in that inner sanctum or something, like backstage or whatever, you don't really feel comfortable going, oh, can I get a photo?
No, because at that point there's a line crossed, you know. And I always felt I was there an observer, reporter, journalist. That was my job. It wasn't to be the fanboy. But as I say, you know, there were certain people that I was, you know, really big fans of and you know, thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed seeing them at work or being in their company. And again, you know, like there were people whose music, like Billy Joel would be a classic example. I was never particularly interested in Billy Joel, but I went over to Sydney and interviewed him over there. And he was just such a nice guy. I mean, he was genuinely nice. He offered me his sandwiches and we just sat and just had a chat as, you know, like two adult men just talking. And he told me about, you know, the divorce that he was going through and how his brother-in-law had fucking ripped him off for all his money. You know, it was just very casual. I just thought, I like you. And then I went and saw the show and I liked him even more because I thought he just sat at the piano, but... No, he got up and played rock guitar and all that kind
of
thing.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Yeah, and so I came away thinking, well, you know, my mistake was to think of Billy Joel as a kind of rock musician or in rock culture. But I realised afterwards he's more like a New York songwriter, you know, he could have been doing Broadway songs or something like that. That's where his sort of reference points are. So he can do that, tell her about it, which I think is the doo-wop kind of song.
Yep.
You know, he just knows that idiom, so he can write like that. But yeah, so yeah, traveling around a lot, I got to meet some interesting people. I as I said before, I like jazz, and my particular highlight was meeting Ornette Coleman, who I just think is one of the, you know, most gifted composers, jazz artists, whatever you call it. And we had a really lovely afternoon in New York together, just sitting, chatting. I honestly, you know, I couldn't understand most of what he was talking about because he was way off the planet.
Yeah.
But then when you listen back, you can see, oh, that's what he meant. And there was a little connection, then he made the leap to something else. So now those people are really interesting, you know,
yeah.
Miles Davis and people like that. So, and of the rock musicians, I always like some of the up and comers. And I was in the UK for a while, and you know, I sort of ran into these bands that Shed Seven were a classic example. I went to see this, you know, they were part of that Britpop movement, and I went to see Shed Seven, and I didn't know anything about them. I'd interviewed them in the afternoon. I liked them very much. I thought they were funny. Got to this big venue, and man, people in the crowd knew every single word of every single song. You know, like the album had only come out about 2 weeks beforehand, and I just thought, oh man, these guys are great. They're going to go for miles, and of course, they were never heard of again. I came back to New Zealand and said, oh man, an interview with Shed Seven. I said, oh no, the album failed here, sort of thing. You know, so I never bothered to write that up. And
yeah,
but you know, other people you could see, like Björk, for example, you just saw straight away, oh, she's going to be huge. You know, you could just tell. So yeah, I mean, they were all, you know, interesting and fun experiences.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so you also look after, well, have a website, which is full of music, but as well as lots of other things. Elsewhere,
recipes you mentioned before.
Yeah, elsewhere.co.nz.
Yeah, elsewhere.co.nz. And I just, because it's my own website, I just do what I like with it. And so as we were saying off air before, you know, I picked up recipes in my travels from, you know, all sorts of different places. And so I just thought, well, you know, amongst all the other things, I'll put up recipes from elsewhere. But there's a lot of music up there, obviously. It's predominantly music.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some every now and again I think, oh, I might just do a brief analysis of that song, but not, you know, dots on a page. Just sort of explain to people, you know, where that song came from and how it worked or whatever. But by and large, it's just sort of album reviews and interviews with people. It keeps me off the streets.
Yep. Well, thank you so much for coming in today. If people want to find out more about your papers at the University of Auckland School of Music,
yeah,
what's the best way? Is it actually to go?
It's all online these days, of course. Yeah. The papers that I'm doing at summer school in the first semester it's a 149G, which means that if you're a music student, you can do it. But if you just want to take it as a general paper, and a lot of people do,
yeah,
and that's the New Zealand music paper that we're talking about before. I'm doing a third year paper in the first semester, which again is sort of the cultural change that happened in the 1960s, using, but not exclusively, you know, how Bob Dylan and how the Beatles actually completely changed the landscape of popular music and what was possible in popular music. You know, prior to that, politics had not been a big part of popular music. Certainly drug induced things hadn't, and also just the change of sonic palette. You know, like you just listen to some of those Beatles songs in the, like, 1966-67, and wow, you know, that is just so unusual. I Am the Walrus, if you just listen to that today with headphones on, you go, what the fuck is this?
Yeah.
You
know, okay.
It's still a surprise. So that's a third-year paper, and you have to be a music student to do that. But,
yep.
if there's any, you know, music students out there, you know, wanting to do a third-year paper, I commend it because it's fun. I really enjoy doing it, and I'm told that it has a big trickle-down effect because the students who are musicians, they quite rightly, they haven't heard this stuff before. You know,
it's
way before their lifetime. And so it comes as, oh, I didn't know that the Beatles were a band that actually progressed from that point and changed their music every album. People don't know that. They
yeah.
just hear Yellow Submarine and She Loves You, and they think they happened at the same time. You know, like, well, no, there was years separating them, and there's a reason why they were different.
So. Yeah, I love the fact that the Beatles were so different from every album.
Yeah, that's sort of what makes you want to listen to the next one.
Yeah.
You know, there's a couple there in a row early on. You think, well, okay, they were kind of jogging on the spot, but a few interesting things happened. Then suddenly it just takes off. And they realise, first of all, they got money, they got power, and they've got two great songwriters, and then a third emerges. Yep. You know, name me another band which has got three out of four people as songwriters. That's pretty rare, eh?
That's awesome, isn't it? Well, thank you so much for coming up today and talking to us. I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you. My pleasure, Penny.
We've
anytime.
Had Graham Reed in the studio. If you also want to check out Elsewhere, it's elsewhere.co.nz. It's a magazine website covering music, arts and travel, and it's got recipes as well. Moroccan
the
lamb?
Moroccan beef is the best.
Oh, yep.
Oh, that's only for meat eaters, of course.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Another friendly face to make your life a little richer. People in your neighbourhood on 95 VFM.